a Ken Burns film.
We stand before you today and declare war on Nazi Germany.
They knew that their mission was to help those in danger get out.
They risked everything.
It's too late to turn our back on what we know is happening.
Every life we touched had its own drama.
We shall never forget what you have done for us.
I owe Mrs. Sharp my life.
Defying the Nazis, the Sharps war. In fast motion, dawn breaks over Prague. Several arched bridges span a wide river running through the city. The scene changes from color footage to grainy black and white.
February 23rd, 1946. My darling Martha, I hope and assume this reaches you on your return from what must have been a very exacting but very successful expedition. I must say that I would like to begin having a home again. The kids don't show their feelings too much.
An old photo of a man with a boy and girl.
I see nothing but men's things in my wardrobe. I smell no perfumes. I have been quite desperate at times. I want to go on for what there is left of life with you.
At night, a train pulls into a station.
7 years ago tonight, we stepped off the train into Wilson Station, and all our world has been different ever since. Ever yours. Wait still.
A film by Ken Burns and Artemis Jakowski. In grainy black and white footage, soldiers shove a group of civilians. Produced by Matthew Justice and Ken Burns. Hundreds of people stream down a city street. Civilians wave to a military official saluting from a train. A montage of photos of men, women, and children. Voices: Tom Hanks as Wait Still Sharp, Marina Goldman as Martha Sharp. German soldiers march in unison. Adolf Hitler salutes from the window of a moving train. Lots of supporters cheer and wave Nazi flags. In a sepia-toned photo, Wait Still, with round-rimmed glasses and thick graying hair parted to one side, stands near a copse of trees. At night, men heave books into a bonfire. In a massive military rally, columns of troops muster in front of Hitler, who stands on a dais with his arms crossed.
Martha and Wait Still Sharp left the comfort of a peaceful, small Massachusetts home in order to go into Europe on the verge of war.
Mordecai Paldiel, Holocaust scholar.
They were motivated from the beginning to go out there into the kingdom of hell and try to get some people out.
It was the second Sunday night of 1939. I had done a full day's work at the church and decided to spend an evening in front of our fireplace. The telephone rang, and it was probably the most momentous telephone call that I ever received. "Hello, Wait Still." I knew whose voice it was. The voice of my closest friend, Everett Baker. "Would you and Martha come over to talk with me at our house here?" "Yes." He said, "Wait Still, Martha. I am inviting you to undertake the first intervention against evil by the denomination to be started immediately overseas."
My husband and I felt that something should be done. Refugees in the Sudetenland had been murdered, and people had been imprisoned and hurt.
We had two small kids, including a very tiny daughter. I said, "How many men have you offered this to?" 17, he said. I said, "Do I understand they've all turned you down?" "Yes. They think a war is definitely coming and they don't want to be in danger." I reassured Martha, "Missionaries leave their children. I'm sure ours can be left in good hands. I want to go, but I won't go without you."
I knew I would miss the children terribly, but we would only be away for a few months. I was torn between my love and duty to my children and to my husband.
As my wife Martha and I went home under the starry skies, we went home with a promise to do it.
A milky expanse of stars rotates across the night sky, defying the Nazis, the Sharps war. Wellesley, Massachusetts. Reverend Jack Mendelson, Unitarian minister.
The core belief of movements like the Unitarian and Universalist movements, belief in freedom, freedom of thought, in the use of reason, and tolerance of difference.
It's a faith that very importantly stresses that the shape of human history, the future of history, is in human hands.
Reverend William Schultz.
A Unitarian minister with profound conviction, a woman who had been deeply committed all her life to social justice, two people very much aware of the world around them, were handed an incredible invitation, a very frightening invitation, a very demanding invitation because of its implications for their family and their church, but an enormous opportunity to actually change history.
I had never felt at home in law school. I took my degree with lasting gratitude for its stern training in analytical and conceptual thinking. But all that time, I had felt a joy in the conducting of service, in work with children, in the friendship and purpose of the Free Church. After graduating from Harvard Law School, I found my true calling.
Wastel Sharp was the kind of minister I wanted to be. That is, he wasn't just the minister of a parish church. He was a civic figure. He was interested in the community in which he worked. He was interested in world affairs. He was interested in the need for peace in the world.
Reason and freedom are the guidelines for our reverence. We are working here at a new adventure. The organization of a church under the governments of reason and freedom, with the democracy of the American town meeting as its form and spirit.
Martha sits for a photo with her son and daughter.
My mother was Martha Sharp. Her family fully expected that when my mother was going to graduate from high school, she would enter the workforce, doing whatever she could to make money for the family.
Martha Content Sharp, daughter.
When she was accepted with a full scholarship to college, they threw all her belongings out the window and told her that she was no longer welcome.
My high school yearbook calls me a good suffragist. They claim I am progressive and advanced. I do believe a woman's place is in the home, but only half the time. After graduating from Brown University, I became a social worker.
She worked for about a year in Chicago at a settlement house with people from all kinds of different backgrounds. That was something that she really took to. I can just imagine her with this diversity of people.
Gonda DeFiglia, Sharp biographer.
I think Martha and Wastel had a very compatible marriage. He thought she was quite unique, beautiful.
Wastel looked very handsome, with strong, muscular shoulders from building stone walls with his father. He had a beautiful, light sense of humor and a creative mind. A carelessly knotted tie and crushed felt hat gave a casual touch to what otherwise might have suggested a rather formal person.
They had the same orientation toward life, the same beliefs, the same sense of obligation, of wanting to do things for others.
In 1933, the year that Wastel Sharp was ordained as a Unitarian minister, Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated as President of the United States, and Adolf Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany.
Hitler came to power January 30th, 1933. Within half a year, the life of every single Jew living in Germany, that's half a million people, was changed, radically changed.
Deborah Dwork, Holocaust survivor.
Hitler was absolutely fixed on the idea of bringing home every person with German blood. And so for those who didn't move back to the Reich, his idea was that the Reich would move out to them. He was enormously successful.
Hitler gazes up at passing planes, March 1938.
They were like flies over Vienna, the Nazi planes.
Rosa Marie Feigl, Vienna.
And of course, people didn't recognize the fact that this was going to be so lethal for any Jew or anyone who opposed the Nazis.
Cheering civilians waved Nazi flags.
The Austrians greeted him with great jubilation.
Heinz Oestreicher, Vienna.
I was only 15 and a half years old at the time. I saw windows of Jewish shops broken and things just stolen.
People gaze into a darkened shop with Jude, J-U-D-E, painted over the front window. Peter Braunfeld, Vienna.
First change I remember is the fact that there was this famous sign about no Jews in the park. That was a huge thing for me because the park is where you met your friends. The park is where you lived in the summer. And so there were big signs that said no Jews in the park. And I remember a general sense of anxiety. I remember a general said, oh, did you hear that so-and-so was deported to Dachau? And people talking about that kind of thing.
An iron gate. Work sets you free.
We didn't realize how quickly it was going to become impossible to flee. But at that point, if you wanted to leave, they said, good luck, go. So that was my father. Then my mother and I stayed until my grandparents were afraid to send me to school because they were stoning the Jewish children on the way to school.
Thousands of people gather in a town square.
We lived right next to the city hall. So we were right in the middle of where everything was happening. And I remember the city hall being decked out with flowers, and I remember the cheering people on the Ringstrasse. I remember big lines in front of the embassy, and then the Gestapo would come along and pick people out of the lines and send them away. I knew that there was something very wrong because my parents were very upset, and I could tell that this was a very bad situation.
He had originally been living in Austria. After the Germans occupied Vienna, then I managed to flee to Prague.
First was the Anschluss in March 1938, the annexation of Austria. Then Hitler cast his eye on the Sudetenland. Germans predominated in a border strip.
Czechoslovakia was a free-thinking, highly cultured, relatively sophisticated place in those interwar years.
Hitler was eager to incorporate those Sudetenland Germans into the Reich.
A headline, sharp lecture hits Nazis.
The immediate cause of Unitarian intervention in overseas evil is the situation in Czechoslovakia. What are we going to do? Their plight's desperate, absolutely desperate. It is too late to turn our back on what we know is happening. Houses being rifled. People being beaten up. Their lives made intolerable, miserable, with nobody to help them at all. My friends, I stand before you today and declare war on Nazi Germany. Face the evil that faces us.
On the morning of our departure, I was hit by the impact of the long absence from the children. Our son Hastings had been very brave about it, though he was quite upset. Martha Content, my baby girl, was jumping up and down and chanting, "Mommy and Daddy going bye-bye." I gathered her up in my arms, trying to explain that we would be gone for a while. Fortunately, she didn't understand. Brushing away tears in my eyes that she had not seen, I kissed her goodbye.
February 4th, 1939. Martha and Waite still smile as they wave.
We sailed from New York to London.
On a map, a dotted blue line traces a course across the Atlantic Ocean.
We learned many things during that stopover. At a secret meeting with the Unitarian and Quaker leadership, we were given a course in some of the techniques of making memos, which cannot be easily deciphered. And if we were not able to make notes, how to memorize key words and remember important data. We learned quickly that we would have to do much of our work abroad in secret.
We also learned various methods of destroying incriminating papers, how to ascertain if we were shadowed, and various ways to elude followers. We were warned that we would be followed and spied upon throughout our mission.
On the map, the line continues on from London, passes through the Netherlands and Germany, then stops in Czechoslovakia.
On February 23rd, we rode into Prague on the Orient Express. As the train ground to a halt into the bitter cold of Wilson Station, we saw a strange sight. The platforms were brimming with women and children weeping on the concrete walkways. We were met by Norbert Chopik, head of the Unitarian Church in Prague. He pointed out a large train which was headed out, filled with men who were fleeing the country.
People stacked luggage in a pile.
It was clear we had come to a nation in crisis.
The next morning, Waitstill and I opened our new office and began sorting through the hundreds of case files that were flooding in.
Men waving papers crowd an office.
We had to select the classes whom we would help. These, then, were to be snatched from the burning. Intellectuals, editors, social workers, professors, and clergymen, whose political records made it necessary for them to flee.
Refugees needed documents. They needed money. They needed assistance. The Sharps stepped into that vacuum.
Handwritten names fill a checklist.
We had lists of thousands of names, all of them requesting exit visas. But it wasn't as easy as simply requesting a visa from a foreign country. Through our contacts in Boston, New York, London, and other cities, we had to arrange for jobs. Places to live. We had to match refugees in Prague with opportunities to live and work abroad.
They knew that their mission was material relief and also to help those in danger get out.
We knew that the Gestapo were monitoring our mail. Our letters had to be smuggled onto transport planes to ensure their delivery.
March 14th, 1939.
On March 14th, I went to the airport with secret documents and witnessed an event that would have a profound effect on the rest of my life. Nicholas Winton had arranged a Kinder transport plane that was to leave from Prague and carry children as well as documents I'd brought to the airport. The parents had brought sweets and other small gifts while saying the mundane things that are usually said before parting. Be good. We'll be together soon. All the while, knowing they might not see them again.
Times were so desperate. People were very thankful if they could get their children onto the transports. I do remember at the airport, my mother was walking up and down with my sister arm in arm, rather pensively. Then also that we had our sort of last meal. And my father took photographs.
Gerda Meyer, Vienna.
The plane was announced. As each child stepped off the exit, he or she waved to their parents, ran across the snow-covered field, waved again, and climbed aboard the plane. The parents' self-control was incredible. Smiling brightly, eyes brimming with tears, they waved back.
Parents waved from behind a barricade.
You know, they thought one of us might be able to escape. He was hoping to come to England.
Suddenly, the engine raced, the plane took off, and it was lost in the low clouds.
Well, my mother and the rest of my family, of course, didn't survive. They would have died in Auschwitz, yes. Well, I'd rather not go and dwell upon it, if you don't mind.
Eyes glistening, Gerda purses her lips.
What madness has brought us here? Both Waitstill and I were securely and unconsciously American. Perhaps it was our free-thinking, democratic, New England Unitarianism that now tied us to the Czechs.
On the morning of the next day, the 15th of March, 1939, we heard the news. The German army was crossing the border and occupying the entirety of Czechoslovakia. Every trace of Czechoslovak democracy vanished as the gray troops poured in through the falling snow.
We found a tremendous crowd waiting in the snow outside our office. The Republic was dead. Their hopes were dust. And they had been betrayed by their friends, France and Great Britain, who had required the Czechs to act morally, while they themselves sold them out for their own safety.
Benito Mussolini salutes a column of passing tanks.
March the 15th, oh, I shall never forget that. It was snowing and raining, and my mother said I didn't have to get up because the Germans invaded.
Silva Samsova, Prague.
And my mother got into the bed with me. And there we were. Instead of having a breakfast, we were just lying in bed, and my mother was very sad. So that was March the 15th. Through the eyes of a child.
I found out that my father died from a heart attack because he was so taken by the invasion of Prague. And so that was my...
Joseph Ben David, Vienna.
15th of March, 1939 experience.
Thousands of soldiers marching, hundreds of tanks in rows and so on. I can only tell you that the Czechs stood there absolutely silent. No cheering, no booing. And of course, after the Germans marched into Prague, the Jewish people there, and there were very many living as refugees there,
Heinz Oestreicher, Vienna,
were in an absolute chaotic state. Nobody knew what to do.
A nighttime curfew was clamped on the city of Prague, announced in both the Czech and the German languages. Achtung, Achtung. And the people, threatened with being shot on sight, left the streets and pulled down the shades of their houses.
Bright flames burn inside a furnace.
The night the Nazis invaded, we found the furnace at the Hotel Atlantic and began to destroy the documents we'd kept on our work. Even at 4 a.m., there was a queue of people, all waiting their turn to approach the furnace. It was a silent line. From this night on, nobody could be trusted.
In fast motion, clouds streak over Prague and the Vltava River.
At 11 a.m., we stood in the town square and saw Hitler standing in the window of the palace. He began to speak. He sounded even wilder than the broadcasts we've heard on the radio.
Hitler salutes from a balcony.
He was nearly ecstatic, I thought. But he looks just as he does in all those pictures.
We realized that we were living in the front lines against Nazism. Wade still looked at me and, holding my hand tightly, whispered, "Courage." The whereabouts of many of the most important refugees were now unknown. Some were said to have reached temporary safety in the embassies. The British government had given us 6 hours to bring several anti-Nazi leaders to British sanctuary if they could be reached. We began to divide up the individuals to be found and brought to safety. I was to meet an unnamed man, Mr. X, and bring him to the embassy.
At night, a car's headlights shine through fog.
Later that evening, I found a taxi in the early darkness, and noting that the driver had a companion in the front seat, gave an address which was near, but not actually the one which was my destination. Arriving at the place, I hastily paid the driver and hurried around the corner, hiding in the first doorway to watch to see whether I was being followed. The companion came around the same corner and looked up and down the street. The driver honked. My heart skipped a beat. I realized that the driver's associate must be a Gestapo agent. I flattened myself against the darkness of the entrance.
In reenactment, Martha's breath steams as she hides in a shadow.
He walked right by. After he passed, I entered the building. I climbed the stairs to the fifth floor and knocked on the door. The door opened, and a man stood before me. He whispered, "I am Mr. X." I told him about the Gestapo agent and the taxi, and we dashed out into the snow and wind. On the walk, we passed no less than 3 Gestapo patrolmen. Each time I spoke in hurried, clear English that we were on our way to the British Embassy. Pretending that Mr. X was my husband, I insisted that Mr. Sharp and myself were already delayed, and we were required by the ambassador, Mr. Swanson. My heart was pounding when the doors to the embassy were in sight. And the 3rd patrolman was holding us up, looking over my passport. He was skeptical of our story. We were chilled to the heart and bone. Finally, he said, "Go," and waved us to the embassy door. Mr. X was one of the lucky ones, but there were still thousands more that desperately needed to get out. The next morning, we were faced with a flood of refugees begging for any kind of visa.
With the public squares under constant surveillance, the churches became the only places where people could gather in numbers. Martha and I attended Unitaria, the First Unitarian Church of Prague, and heard a sermon delivered by Dr. Norbert Chopik that was particularly full of double meanings. After the service, we met secretly with Dr. Chopik and his board of trustees. They needed us to transmit a message. They wanted the American church to understand that they would be faithful unto death to the ideals of democracy. I shall never forget their burning eyes, clenched fists, and fierce spirit as they spoke.
Franklin Roosevelt speaks at a session of Congress.
For a fleeting moment, we had the vain hope that the urgent needs of the Czech people might move the U.S. Congress to open the country's doors.
Martha and Waitstill Sharp had to struggle against the immigration restrictions of their own government.
Mordecai Paldil.
Our requests for special consideration were being ignored in Washington. The old U.S. quota for Czechoslovakia allowed 2,800 Czechs to enter the U.S. yearly on immigration visas. At that pace, most refugees realized that they might wait several decades to get an American visa. But looking that far into the future was a luxury. For most refugees, their greatest need was finding a safe bed for the night.
There was an enormous anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Semitism, and deep racism.
No country, literally no country, was prepared to take Jewish refugees after the Nazis entered Prague. We found out very quickly that to get any further where we could live permanently was nearly impossible.
I shall never forget the shock when I saw a Jewish man being abused on the street. I would have cried aloud in anger if Waitstill had not silenced my spontaneous outburst. All my life I hated unfairness, and as I spoke to individual Jewish refugees, I felt their dignity and recognized their amazing capacity to rise above Nazi mistreatment.
Jewish couples sit on a crowded bench.
On March 24th, I met with Tessa Roundtree from the Quaker Underground. She asked me to help smuggle groups of refugee families by train through the heart of Nazi Germany.
A locomotive pulls out of a tunnel and approaches a building nestled among mountains. Peter Braunfeld, Vienna.
So my father went through a great deal getting a permit to get out. And so there was this problem about how do you get from Prague to London without going through Germany. It is essentially impossible.
The groups included some of the most wanted and well-known anti-Nazis and their families, including one of the most famous surgeons in the world, a female scientist, and 2 journalists. But of course, we had to hide their identities. They were to leave the country under the guise of household workers, so that if their papers were checked, they would appear to be simple gardeners, cooks, or farmers. Once we made the arrangements to take the refugees on this perilous ride, I didn't know if I would ever see Waitstill again. The train was announced. We got on board, everyone deeply moved at parting, for they were not sure if we would reach our destination.
We were going from Prague, Dresden, Leipzig, to the Dutch border.
If the Gestapo should charge us with assisting the refugees to escape, prison would be a light sentence. Torture and death were the usual punishments.
Surrounded by a barbed wire fence, prisoners stand with their hands behind their heads.
At the German border, our passports and visas were carefully examined. My heart was pounding as I thought about Waitstill, Hastings, and young Martha Content.
Soldiers carry rifles while patrolling with German shepherd dogs.
When you got to the border, they came by and said, "Alle Juden aussteigen." All the Jews had to get out. They separated the men and the women. We didn't know if we'd ever see each other again. They checked you, and they really checked you. I mean, they did very careful examination, every possible orifice in your body. At one point, one of the German officers said, "Is that all?" And my father said, "Yes." And they said, "What's that on your finger?" And he said, "Well, that's a wedding ring." And they said, "No, you can't take that with you." So they took it off, and that was the end of his wedding ring. And shortly after the train pulled out of the station, an SS man came. And I remember that. It was a very dramatic thing. So we had the joy of riding with an SS man for 6 hours. I was sleeping most of the time. And my mother was terrified, you know, if I were to kick him or something, then that would be the end of us all.
We're traveling all through Germany. We weren't even allowed to look out of the window, you see.
Two trains pass each other at high speed.
The windows had to be blacked out all the time. And I remember, see, these long periods, you see, when it wasn't moving at all.
At the final border crossing, the customs officers came aboard to check my list against their documents. Then I heard my name called. Two of the journalists in my party were standing on the platform with their luggage, trembling with fear. The officials had ordered them off the train and were going to send them back to Germany because their names did not appear on my list. Quickly, I turned away and added the men's names to the list. These two men are in my party. Shaking his head, he okayed their passports. And we all climbed aboard the train once again.
A hollow-cheeked engineer stares straight ahead as he drives the train, which leaves behind a thick plume of white steam. Elsewhere, a windmill overlooks boats floating in a canal.
And then we were in Holland. And I remember my parents being ecstatic.
We arrived in Holland, exhausted and relieved. And then I took the group by boat to London.
Silhouetted people climb up an ocean liner's gangplank. In London, a bicyclist pedals past a double-decker bus and other traffic.
I have a picture showing us when we first arrived in England, and it shows the clothes we came in. And they were the Austrian national costume, and those were literally the only clothes we had. We weren't allowed to take anything else.
Heinz Oesterreicher reads a letter.
"Dear Mrs. Sharp, we shall never forget what you have done for us and wish to thank you from the depth of our hearts."
Handwritten signatures fill the bottom of the letter.
Every life we touched had its own drama. One can only manage a miracle every so often. But a series of miracles can happen when many people become concerned and are willing to act at the right time.
Within a few days, Martha was back with Waitstill in Prague. Deborah Dwork, Holocaust scholar.
The Germans ordered all refugee aid and assistance operations to cease.
We fed 350 refugees two meals each day at the Salvation Army. One day, the Gestapo came to our office, lined the refugee men facing the wall, and an officer beat the refugees' heads with a revolver until they fell senseless in their own blood. The Gestapo was looking for refugees reported to have eaten at this Salvation Army. Neither the refugees nor the Gestapo knew that I was the American source of these meals.
We found we were being followed everywhere we went. The Nazis began to close in on anybody they thought was an enemy. And they certainly thought that we were enemies.
And in the meantime, our hotel bedroom was searched three times. We have to assume by the Gestapo, trying to figure out what these two crazy Americans were doing here.
I found myself so disturbed by the pressures and serious consequences of making the slightest mistake. I changed from a rather naive, friendly, and outgoing person who trusted everyone to a self-contained and increasingly wary individual who began to consider every word spoken.
The Sharps had entered Czechoslovakia on February 23rd, which is before the Germans had come in mid-March. That was very lucky for both of them because it meant that the visas that they had obtained allowed them to leave and return to the country on short visits.
Trolley circle a city statue.
We decided that in order to be the most effective, we'd have to separate. The operation desperately needed financing, and we were not getting enough support. I would continue dealing with individual cases in Prague, and Waitstill would go abroad to raise money. It was the first time in our marriage that we would be apart for more than a few days.
In a photo, Waitstill wears a white suit and hat, while Martha wears a white hat and patterned dress.
Waitstill wrote to me from Paris on April 29th. You are not only beautiful, but a brick. That rare combination spells out the perfect woman, the answer to the quest of the ages. I really mean this. Venus and Minerva cast in one blended statue of loveliness and wisdom. That's you. Ever my beloved madam, your most fortunate servant, Waitstill.
173 Boulevard Saint-Germain, Paris, France. Dearest Martha, these long silences surely are trying. Why don't you write, even if you send no more than a postal card? I shall certainly hope for a word from you tomorrow. I think I shall have to try out for the Wounded Love section at the Paris Opera. Now do please write me. Ever yours. Waitstill.
My darling Waitstill, I am terribly lonely without you, and all today I've been wondering how I could possibly stand it for another 10 days. The fact of thinking of Hastings off in his little aloneness, and Martha by herself, and you in Paris, and of myself here, has been nearly too much. I think that the experience has made me realize how much I love you, and how horrible it would be if anything should happen to you. I have been reading Lady Chatterley's Lover, which I should like to discuss with you when I get back. The parish would disown me if they knew that book. And I've been thinking about the things that we ought to do that we don't. Somehow we've got to begin to tell the world where it gets off. All my love, Martha.
In a montage of handwritten correspondence, a letter penned on Hotel Paris Praha stationery is dated Sunday, July 23rd, 1939.
By then, the Sharps had a significant impact. They'd also learned to work the system. Waitstill was particularly good at the black market, at exchanging Czech currency, which was worthless outside of Czechoslovakia by that point, for American currency. He would pay about 10 cents on the dollar for every Czech crown, and he would provide the refugees a handwritten note which indicated that when they got to London or when they got to Paris, they could go to a bank and they would exchange that note for the local currency, which was worth a significant amount of money.
Desperate Czech people approaching me in increasing numbers would, in some way or another, open a briefcase or a small trunk and pull out bales of Czechoslovak money. I agreed to exchange their Czech money with U.S. currency from what was left of our operations funds. There was a sliding scale, the most needy getting the best rate of exchange. They couldn't cross the border with foreign currency, so I went in and out of Prague 7 times and placed the dollars in banks strategically in Geneva, London, and Paris, so that if they could escape, their money would be waiting for them.
A man stands at a barred cashier's window.
I knew it was illegal, but I did it because I had no other choice. I was beyond the pale of civilization. I owed no ethics to anybody. I owed no honesty to anybody at all if I could save imperiled human lives. Everything had to be carried out in the head and as a word of honor. I had never been a good bargainer, but there was a sudden excess of adrenaline born of my hatred of the Nazis. And my intention, which may qualify as a Christian intention, to do as much as I could for these people.
In archival footage, a man in a Nazi uniform raises his arm while standing outside a shop. Another rubs his nose while turning toward the camera.
The Sharps carried on. They kept putting off the authorities until they came to the office and found the doors locked and furniture thrown out onto the street.
Broken glass lies on a countertop. August 20th, 1939.
Waitstill had gone out to a meeting in Geneva, and finally the Gestapo tore up his return permission so that he was not going to be able to come back in again. And then I received word from my underground. The Nazis are going to arrest you and take you to prison. I packed everything I could, got aboard a train, and went straight up to London. I met my husband, and we both sailed back to the United States on the Queen Mary.
As we plowed west through sunlit seas, we were summoned to the Grand Salon. The radio crackled out the news, and we heard the voice of the Prime Minister of England. The Parliament of England declares that a state of war obtains now between the United Kingdom and the Imperial German government, announcing the end of peace in our time. The order had been sent down from the captain's bridge, give her the max. The ship came alive. She hit the great waves of the North Atlantic with such violence that the sea came right over the ship.
We were no longer aboard a civilian ocean liner. We had become a war target. The course of our ship was changed to run north, for German submarines had been reported due west, waiting to sink this pride of the British fleet. Portholes were fastened and painted black to prevent the light from showing. And nobody was allowed to smoke on deck at night.
This was the biggest ship in the world. Of course, she was no match for any German torpedoes.
In dark, rainy footage, a large ship races through ocean waters. By day, a man and woman view the Statue of Liberty from a ship's deck.
Well, she made it. We landed. And the chapter was over.
We docked in New York, and we're back in another world. Love, children's arms, plentiful food. And the only tension that concerned Americans in September seemed to be which baseball team would win the series.
A player slides into home plate.
Most Americans were not really concerned with the war, nor did they understand why it was declared.
One after another, children slide down a sliding board.
Life was still pretty secure in the good old United States of America.
When my parents returned home, I remember
Father would write his sermons on Saturday. He would preach on Sunday.
A photo of a girl in pigtails.
Lunch would be a Q&A about the sermon. I really wasn't terribly excited about the sermons at that point in time. I was too young.
Young Martha Content rides in a canoe with her family and pet dog.
When we were in Lake Sunapee, that definitely is a time that I can remember that we were together.
Elsewhere, a young boy sits in a round metal tub. Waitstill Sharp and his extended family gather at a cluttered table. A rustic dwelling sits in a snow-covered waterfront landscape.
The Sharps, they've undertaken this harrowing mission. They've been successful. But the situation is worse than ever. Many of the Czech refugees whom the Sharps had helped resettle in France now, of course, were under threat once again because Germany was threatening France.
In the late spring of 1940, I was working in my office when a telephone call came from Frederick Elliott,
President, American Unitarian Association.
He said, "I want to inform you that you and Martha have been chosen to return to Europe this summer, leaving as soon as you can." I was taken aback by this and said, "Dr. Elliott, my family has been broken up. We are eagerly counting upon a vacation. My family needs reunion. I have two young children who need steady parenting. Europe is falling to pieces, and you talk about vacation? I won't hear the word. You must go. There's no debating it." I proceeded home and explained this to Martha.
And I said no. We had just been away months before, and I had left my two children, and I really didn't want to go again. And so I sat in the church and was amazed when Frederick Elliott announced that Waitstill and Martha Sharp would go back to Europe. I thought we had decided together not to go.
A Western Union telegram from Frederick and Elizabeth Elliott. Our thoughts go with you.
We agreed with serious misgivings about our children that we would go.
That was the beginning of when they began to lose each other.
Martha went to Europe because her husband wanted to go. The wife was considered to be the husband's right hand. If you're a minister's wife, you are doing part of the ministry. That was just the way it worked.
Was I angry at my mother? Of course I was angry at my mother. I must have been angry at both of them.
In a photo, young Martha Content glares toward the camera. June 14, 1940. In archival footage, soldiers march through a park. Deborah Dwork, Holocaust scholar.
The original idea had been for a Unitarian office and base of operations in Paris.
And to the world's absolute amazement and fear.
Standing at a low wall, Hitler and others gaze at the Eiffel Tower.
France fell.
David Wyman, Holocaust scholar.
The Germans in 6 weeks conquered what was considered to be the strongest army other than Germany, on the continent.
In close-up, Hitler gazes around and turns back toward the tower.
Because the Germans had invaded Paris, Portugal had become our base of operations. We established an office at the Hotel Metropole in Lisbon and made contact with our network of rescue workers to assess the situation. We learned that the Germans had cut off all supplies to the south of France.
Vichy, France.
The north of France was blocked by the German army, so nothing could travel.
Paul Mirat, author.
So, of course, there was a lack of meat, lack of vegetable, of fruits, of milk.
Milk was the one thing they needed to keep the babies alive. Waitstill and I began negotiating with the Nestle company to arrange a complicated delivery by train. 6 weeks later, after many delays, we were finally able to present a 13-ton trainload of powdered milk to the local midwives, who then distributed it to the hungry children.
Women and children carry their belongings down the road.
The situation was still dire. Everyone was affected by the occupation of France, and there was a mass evacuation to the south.
Justice Rosenberg, Danzig.
And that's when really the refugee problem
begins. People got panicky and started to leave into the countryside south.
A man wheels a child in a pushcart.
It was incredible to see the exodus. You have to visualize hundreds of thousands of people on the roads.
A long line of men ride bicycles down a narrow country road. Catherine Chevaney, France.
My father left Paris on a bicycle, taking just what he could carry, which was really very sensible because people who had cars and dogs and canaries and mattresses and so on got stuck on the road.
Clement Brown, France.
My mother said, we're going to leave and we put everything into an automobile that belonged to one of the medics at the hospital. He was to drive us out of the city going toward the south of France. The car overheated. We left all our goods in the middle of the street.
An airplane flies low over a road.
We were strafed by aircraft, and a French farmer pushed me down into the ground. I thought it was a game. This is just fun. And my mother started to cry. Slowly, you get the message that something is drastically wrong.
A million French, along with thousands of Belgians and other foreigners, fled to the south. They were all full of fear.
Gauthier, Justice Rosenberg, Danzig.
Therefore, the big question is, how do you people get out of France? And one way was to get them out illegally. I became the courier of the American Rescue Committee. I looked very young.
A photo of young Rosenberg in a suit.
I looked very Aryan. And, believe it or not, very innocent.
In another photo, a man leans over a slanted desk.
One interesting case is that of the writer Leon Feuchtwanger. Leon Feuchtwanger had been a very successful German-Jewish writer. He had taken refuge to France also.
Mordechai Paldiel, Holocaust scholar.
He's a Jew, an anti-Nazi. So when the Germans entered France, they really wanted to lay their hands on him. So Feuchtwanger was quite in jeopardy.
A notice contained a listing of names.
The Germans, they had a list of particular German-Jewish refugees whom they wanted to incarcerate. Feuchtwanger was on that list. The clock was ticking.
A photo of Feuchtwanger behind barbed wire.
And since he's German, he is put in a concentration camp. In a French concentration camp.
People had appealed to Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of the president, to have this very famed author brought to the United States. It had to be done very quickly before the French turned him over to the Germans. And so a certain man in the American consulate actually went out by himself in a diplomatic car to that French camp outside of the city of Nîmes. They stole him out of the camp and they brought him to Marseille.
He was spirited out and hidden first in the villa of Hiram Bingham.
Now the problem was to get him out of France. The French police was looking for him.
Steam rises from a locomotive.
In the early morning darkness, I boarded the train with a group of endangered intellectuals, including Feuchtwanger and his wife, Marta. And we began our escape. We were on the train for only a half hour when a man knocked on the door to our compartment. I stepped outside and he said, Mr. Sharp, you and your party must get off at the next stop. This train is going to be searched by French agents. I did not know how he knew my name. I had to assume he was an operative sent by the U.S. consulate. For the next few minutes, as we neared Narbonne, I faced the most difficult decision of my life, because I figured that this might be a trap. But in times of war, you have to trust some people. The operative said that Vichy French agents, acting at the behest of the Nazis, knew that we were headed towards the border. I had to take responsibility in the next few minutes and decide what to do. I went down the length of the train and quietly informed the group that we would be getting off at the next stop. I instructed them to scatter when we disembarked as though we were tourists visiting Narbonne. This was very important. We would have to hide out for several hours until we could catch the next train. We stepped off the train and I stayed with Voigtwanger, the most wanted man in the group. We nervously strolled through Narbonne.
A dog watches young men tussle in the middle of a tree-lined street leading to a cathedral.
The hours finally passed, and the group boarded the next train to our destination. I was surprised to see the agent again. He gave more instructions to disembark at Cerbère, where the group would rest for the night.
Canoes sit on a rocky shore of a coastal village.
I was also told to visit Dr. Otto Meyerhoff, a Jewish Nobel Prize-winning biochemist, who was hiding out in a small coastal village north of Cerbère. He was in a desperate state, convinced that he would be captured by the Nazis. As we walked along the beach, I begged him to join our party. He would not commit.
Susan Subak, author.
If you didn't have that French exit visa, really the way to get out of France was actually to walk on foot over the mountains. They used a route that smugglers had used.
We were ready to make our escape. This was a complicated mission, and I was not alone. It was a collaborative effort with Varian Fry's Emergency Rescue Committee and Leon Ball, a brave American who helped guide refugees across the border. We took the group to the start of a smuggler's path, and the order of events was this. Those crossing would depart in half-hour increments. The least likely to be recognized would go first, carrying cigarettes and money to bribe the border guards. I would take all their luggage by train, planning to meet them on the other side of the border. This is an extremely taxing climb. The mountains are unforgiving. This is no man's land between France and Spain, and I was not certain if they would encounter armed guards or no one at all. But the charm of cigarettes and money held fast, and the border guards stayed corrupted. The group made it through, and we assembled at a rail station on the Spanish side of the border, waiting for the train to Madrid. 4 hours later, we arrived in Madrid, where we could catch a train to Lisbon to make our final journey across the Atlantic.
A map traces a route across Spain and Portugal.
Leon Voigtwanger came home in the lower berth of my little stateroom, which was to have been occupied by Martha Sharp. The first evening on the boat, he looked at me and, smiling inquisitively, said, "May I address you, sir, as though you were a character in one of my novels? Why are you here, doing what you are doing? How much are you paid? Is there a payoff here from some agency?" I said, "I'm not paid any salary at all. I think something frightful, in addition to what has befallen Europe, is going to befall now. I'm not a saint. I'm just as capable of the many sins of human nature as anyone else. But I believe that the will of God is to be interpreted by the liberty of the human spirit." "Well, this is a surprising answer," he said. "You get enough reward out of that?" I said, "Yes, I do. Our lives, including my life and certainly my liberties, are in the hands of somebody. And I don't like to see guys get pushed around."
A portrait of Waitstill Sharp fades into footage of an ocean liner cutting through ocean waters.
Finally, we arrived in New York Harbor, steamed past the Statue of Liberty, and it had never meant as much to me as it did then.
A photo portrait of Martha and the children.
But my elation was short-lived. I knew that Martha was still in peril. How would I tell our children that their mother hadn't come home?
Hastings Sharp, son. Gray-haired Hastings wears a dark suit and tie.
"This is a letter I received when I was 8 years old. Dear Hastings, I am sending you this letter by Clipper. I love you, and I miss you very much. Now I have some very important news for you. Here in France today, the children do not have enough food. I shall not return home with Dad. I must wait until I can make all the arrangements for the children. So I must give up seeing you until about your birthday.
In a group photo, Martha smiles with adults and children.
Now I send you my love and many kisses. Loving, Mommy.
A photo of young Hastings, his brow furrowed as he stares into the camera.
I had chosen the welfare of children as my project for this tour of duty. Hundreds of families had appealed to send their children to the United States. That is how the Children's Immigration Project began. I felt I could not abandon them. If we could arrange for one group of children to leave, others would follow. It was my moral duty to lead the first group myself.
My father went from consulate to consulate trying to get visas to go anywhere that was plausible. That's how he met Martha Sharp, who saved my life.
White-haired Rosemarie Feigl, Vienna.
And my father said to Mrs. Sharp, oh, if you could just include my girls in the group of children to go to America. And she said, well, the group is full. And as it turned out, at the last minute,
silver-haired Catherine Chevaney, France,
two boys who were going to go with the group did not show up.
Footage of children boarding a ship.
And so my sister and I were included.
Brown-haired Mercedes Brown, France.
And this is with the paper that obviously was filled out so that we could start our journey.
A photo of young Brown is attached to a document.
And it must have been very painful for my mother to do this.
Yehuda Bauer, Holocaust scholar.
Heartbreaking as it was for the parents, they wanted to rescue their children first and foremost. So they handed them over to strangers rather than endanger them by keeping them with them.
There's a tendency...
Jean Thies Whitaker, France.
...that you can protect your children by holding them close, you know, and keeping them under your arms. But in a circumstance such as that war, that instinctive reaction may not be the wise one.
A curly-haired girl and a light-haired boy wave toward the camera. Next, the portrait of a woman and two children.
My mother had died somewhere along the way. It was very difficult for my father to talk about his wife's death.
The Vichy French would not let parents leave. They couldn't take us out.
Joseph Strasser, Vienna.
Here you are, 8 years old. You don't have your mom and dad. Come on now. I mean, you know, this is very difficult for a child. And it has different effects. It had a different effect on my brother as it did on me.
In a photo, a boy stares with closed lips while a younger boy beside him smiles. Alex Strasser, Vienna.
I can see that when how difficult it would be for a parent, a father who lost his wife, to put his two children on a boat and with the likelihood that he would never see them again.
And my brother, he was torn up, and so was I, but somebody had to stand up, so I stood up as best as I could. You're going to a new land, new language. It's devastating for a child that age.
Father said, read, write, and study, and become a doctor. They can take everything from you, but not your memory.
Alex blinks back tears. On an official document, a girl smiling photo lies beside a raised seal featuring an American eagle.
I must have not wanted to go to America. So I don't think I was told very much ahead of time. My mother just packed my things. Martha gave us all beige berets and there are pictures of us in those beige berets.
Mrs. Sharp had decided on the berets as a way of recognizing all the children.
Whitaker holds up a photo.
Yeah, I'm the tallest.
Clement Brown, France. Clement unsnaps a beige cap.
I haven't undone that in 66 years.
He puts it on, then adjusts his glasses.
Yeah, maybe. Thank you. All right.
And we were on a boat called the Excambion, which was later sunk. Fortunately, not with us on it.
What they did was make the ballroom into a dormitory. They just put mattresses on the floor.
The boys and girls were separated by a curtain.
I do remember being told that we were called when we arrived, the two tigers on that ship. We apparently...
The Strasser brothers.
...misbehaved on the ship.
A graphic traces a route across the Atlantic to New York City.
I remember seeing the Statue of Liberty.
The best Christmas gift I ever got was being brought here, in this country.
December 23rd, 1940.
We arrived in New York, and some Red Cross ladies had a table with cocoa. And that was really very welcome. It made us feel that America must be a great place.
News of the day, New York Harbor.
The American liner Excambian arrives with child refugees from Europe. Youngsters scarcely able to believe they're free from the terrors of war. Triply joyous are the 13-year-old Diamante Triplet.
Girls in berets.
Dear American, we are very happy that you are here. And we are very grateful that you was coming to America.
Where do you come from, Teresa?
From Kent.
Were you there during the war?
Yes.
Tell us about it, Teresa.
It was very bad. We had not enough to eat. And my parents sent me to America for my health.
A young girl in a beret.
I come from France and I saw lots of misery. There was anything to eat. And there was lots of bombardment in Marseille, and I saw lots of people killed.
What I owe Martha is my life in America. Perhaps my life itself.
A black and white family photo.
The Strasser family would not exist if we hadn't been on that ship.
In a present-day color photo, the brothers pose with their family members, including two young boys.
She said that anybody would have done that. I don't think so. No. Only a special person would have done that. Would have left their own children and gone and taken care of other children.
Martha's immigration project became a model for future rescues. In December 1941, the United States was finally forced to join the war that had been raging in Europe and Asia for more than 2 years.
December 7, 1941.
Bombs drop on Pearl Harbor.
A date which will live in infamy.
Elsewhere, men fire from narrow flat boats speeding toward a shoreline. Troops storm onto the shores of Normandy. Some are cut down by gunfire soon after stepping onto the beach. Paratroopers fill the sky. Flames shoot from the back of a jeep as it flees bombardment. Soldiers aim rifles in a snow-covered landscape. Elsewhere, artillery fire. In a bombed-out area, groups of men carry dead or wounded in makeshift slings. Surrendering soldiers march with raised hands. A soldier displays a Nazi flag beside another holding a machete. Elsewhere, a woman and child walk amidst bodies lying on the grounds of a concentration camp. Victims with shaved heads lie piled atop a transport vehicle. Men in dark uniforms carry what appears to be a coffin. A giant American flag rises in front of a swastika atop a building. Elsewhere, a mushroom cloud. In color footage, civilians and servicemen cheer and wave from a convertible. An electronic sign, "Japs surrender." Engaged in a long embrace, a man and woman kiss while others watch in a crowded street. Next, a photo of the Sharps' home. All through the war, Waitstill and Martha continued their efforts to help rescue refugees. At the same time, Martha was drawn to a host of other political causes. Next, a photo of Martha in front of a large banner bearing her name.
My mother was drafted by the Democratic Party to run for Congress.
It was something he didn't want. He absolutely did not want. She really spent a lot of time away from home.
In a series of photos, Martha meets with various people, including Albert Einstein.
She ran for Congress alone. I mean, that takes guts.
A Time magazine cover depicts an elephant dancing in a boxing ring.
She lost the election against the person who became Speaker of the House, Joe Martin.
Gonda DeFigli, a biographer.
Several people who've known them have told me that they really felt that she started to grow in her own self and no longer needed to be partnered with him. Now, she went back to Europe. They went to Europe together twice, but the third time she went alone.
February 23rd, 1946. My darling Martha.
A typed letter.
I hope and assume this reaches you on your return from what must have been a very exacting but very successful expedition. I must say that I would like to begin having a home again, with travel the exception, instead of counting those days on the calendar when mother is at home and of finding them few. The kids don't show their feelings too much. But we finally could not count on any time that you wouldn't be off to a talk or a tea or a committee meeting. I see nothing but men's things in my wardrobe. I smell no perfumes. I have been quite desperate at times. I want to go on for what there is left of life with you. 7 years ago tonight, we stepped off the train into Wilson Station, and all our world has been different ever since.
I don't think they ever really told me that they were going to separate. And I was living at that time with my father alone. I know that I had to go to court and I had to declare which parent I wanted to live with. And I said, neither one.
A photo of young Martha content staring up at her mother.
Martha did mention how disruptive it was for Martha Jr. when she came back. I do know that she was regretful about the effect it had had on her children, leaving them for such a very long time. I remember Wade still telling me that the work in Europe had destroyed his marriage. I also remember him telling me that it was the most extraordinary experience of his life. So I'm not sure he would have not done it over again.
A sharp family portrait. Wade Still and Martha were divorced in 1954. In June 2006, the State of Israel awarded one of its highest honors, Righteous Among the Nations, to Martha and Wade Still Sharp. Of more than 25,000 so honored, only five are Americans. Varian Fry, Lois Gundon, Roddy Edmonds, and Wade Still and Martha Sharp. All of them had risked their lives trying to save Jews from the Holocaust. Garden of the Righteous Among the Nations.
It is a singular honor for me and my family to represent my parents, Martha and Wade Still Sharp, as they are honored today as righteous among the nations. They were modest and ordinary people. They responded to the suffering and needs around them, as they would have expected everyone to do in a similar situation. They never viewed what they did as extraordinary.
Yad Vashem, Israel, the Hall of Remembrance.
Martha Jakowski and I lit the eternal flame. That was very moving to me and very scary because I looked at that fire and of course I thought of my grandparents who were burned to death in Auschwitz.
Rosemarie Feigl lived with foster parents in the United States for 2 years before her parents were also able to escape. She worked in New York City as a mural painter until her death in 2009. Peter Braunfeld fled Europe with his parents and settled in the United States. He is a professor emeritus of mathematics at the University of Illinois. Heinz Oestreicher escaped to London with his father and brother, and in 1942 joined the Royal Air Force. He changed his name to Henry Walsh and lives in England. The Brown siblings were reunited with their parents in New York. Mercedes Brown retired after a career in publishing. Clement Brown was a school teacher and served in the U.S. Army. He died in 2013. Brown salutes wearing his beige cap. Catherine Chevaney lived with family friends in Massachusetts until her parents could get out of France. She became a renowned linguist and is a professor emerita of Russian at MIT. Alex Strasser did become a doctor. He is still practicing. Joseph Strasser became a public administrator and an advocate for animal rights. Jean Thies Whitaker lived with family friends in Pennsylvania after her rescue. She is a professor emerita of French at Wheaton College. Gerda Meyer's parents were murdered by the Nazis during the Holocaust. An author and poet, she lives in England. White-haired Meyer rests her hand over her mouth as she stares into the camera. She removes her hand. Next, footage of triplet girls in berets, followed by a present-day video of three elderly women. The Diamante triplets were reunited with their parents in the United States. Dr. Norbert Čapek of the Czech Unitarian Church was arrested by the Gestapo and taken to Dachau. He was tortured and killed in 1942. The writer Leon Feuchtwanger was granted political asylum in the United States and settled in Los Angeles. He died in 1958. Nobel laureate Otto Meyerhoff was able to escape France. He became a professor of biochemistry at the University of Pennsylvania. He died in 1951. The true identity of Mr. X is still not known. He was most likely a dissident Czech journalist. For a decade after the war, Wait Still Sharp continued to help refugees and fight for civil rights in the United States. Next, a photo of elderly Sharp. He returned to the ministry in 1957 and remarried that same year. He led congregations in Michigan, Iowa, and Massachusetts until his retirement in 1972. Wait Still Sharp died in 1983. After losing the congressional election in 1946, Martha Sharp worked in the Truman administration. In the 1950s, she secretly advised the Israeli government, helping displaced Jews throughout the Middle East. Next, a photo of older Martha. In 1957, she remarried. Martha devoted the rest of her life to raising money for Jewish causes. She died in 1999. March 1990.
I know that if I asked you to do something,
Martha Sharp,
that you knew just a little of your effort and a little of your contribution would make it possible for you to really aid a family to live, let's say, for a week, I'll bet you do it.
This film was dedicated to all the individuals who were not saved. As the graphic fades, the word "not" lingers on the screen. Description made possible by a grant from the U.S. Department of Education. Description created by NCI Described Media. A list of credits displayed beside black and white photos of Wait Still Sharp and Martha Sharp.
Defying the Nazis, The Sharps War is available on DVD. The companion book is also available. To order, visit shoppbs.org or call 1-800-PLAY-PBS. This program is also available for download from iTunes.
Smiling, the Sharps wave while looking off into the distance. Next, four children pose while huddled together. Children and adults pose for a group photo. Another photo of the Sharps. A co-production of Florentine Films and No Limits Media. Executive producer Ken Burns.